Thanks. And thanks very much for having me. So I guess since it's such a tiny audience, we can try and do this a bit more like a discussion, I suppose. So please, you know, pipe up and go off on tangents if, or draw me off on tangents if you feel like. So what I'm going to talk about is doing beyond the standard model global fits. And if you don't know what global fits are, you will soon. And including astroparticle data in those. And specifically, that means including searches for dark matter in the global fits. So I'll start off basically just, you know, outlining this problem and describing why we would want to do global fits in the first place. And then talk about including three different pieces of astroparticle data in the global fits. So I'll go through gamma ray searches for dark matter, neutrino searches for dark matter, and also CMB constraints on dark matter annihilation. And then I guess the last third or so of the talk is meant to be about the future challenges in global fits kind of as a whole. So I'll outline a couple of these challenges, in particular the challenge of creating respectable likelihood functions for LHC searches for new physics, and some statistical and numerical issues that are starting to come up now that we're looking at higher dimensional models than just the simplest versions of supersymmetry. And talk a bit about, basically, I write here moving from parameter space to theory space. So what this basically means is analyzing a lot more theories in terms of global fits than have been done so far. Because so far, we've really only looked at, I guess you can count them on one hand, sort of number of models.
What does the adjective respectable have to do with likelihoods?
Well, you find likelihoods non-respectable by definition, well, I guess you'll see, but respectable means something that you would not be ashamed to put your name to, basically. Okay, so you guys basically all know this. We've got lots of reasons to look for new physics, right? So what are we going to do about it? There are these basically, you know, four ways we might do it. We'll make new particles at high-energy colliders, study rare processes at high luminosity colliders, or hunt for dark matter, or look for something in neutrino physics. So I guess a lot of my work is based around this hunting for dark matter, but many of the things I'm going to talk about also draw on high-energy collider searches and high-luminosity collider searches. Okay, so what we're really trying to do here is combine different searches for new physics. So then the question becomes, how should you do that? So, I mean, the reason we want to do this is we want to know, you know, which models are in, which ones are out, which combinations of parameters are in, and which ones are out. So the very simplest way you can do this, of course, is to look at individual searches and then plot regions that are allowed and excluded in the parameter spaces of the theories that you're interested in, overlap all of those regions and say that the ones that, you know, don't fall into an excluded region are still allowed, right? So this is basically the simplest example you could imagine of that sort of search. So here I've given an example of the parameter space of the scalar singlet model. So this is basically just adding one scalar singlet to the standard model, imposing a Z2 symmetry to make it stable, and looking for it as a dark matter candidate. So here you have a region in gray ruled out by the relic density of this scalar S. So in this gray region, you would overproduce the relic density compared to the observed relic density of dark matter. In the region above that curve, you would be safe in the sense that you'd have a subdominant dark matter candidate, and on this curve, you'd have exactly the right relic density. Here in pink, you have the bound from decays of the Higgs boson to two of these new scalars. And of course, you know, this cuts off at half the Higgs boson mass. And at larger couplings here, lambda HS, you see that you get too large a decay rate of the Higgs to these two S's. And this would not show up, but it would be, it's constrained by combined fits to the different decay branching fractions of the Higgs. So this is the invisible the limit on the invisible decays of the Higgs. And then here we have limits from direct detection of dark matter. So you're looking for scattering of the S on nucleons in direct detection searches. And then the different colours basically just correspond to different target masses of your detector. So the dark curve gives the limit from xenon 100, the current limit, and then the other curves are basically just scaling up the target mass. And then this final very light one is what we would expect from xenon 1-ton. So this is the simplest, basically most naive way you could combine different searches. You just overplot these bounds, and you say from all of this, what I've got left is this kind of trapezoidal shaped region in white here that's still allowed, and I'd say that everything else is ruled out. Now, of course, what this ignores is basically what the confidence levels that I have said all of these things are ruled out with, and it ignores any combination really of the different searches and so on. So, I mean, that works very well if you just have two parameters, right? You just plot them in that plot and you only have a small number of searches. But if you have multiple constraints, you really want to combine them in some kind of consistent way. So you want to consider the fact that if something's ruled out by two things, then it's actually ruled out more strongly than if it's just ruled out by one, right? So you want to combine them in some kind of statistically valid way. And the way to do that is basically by making up a composite likelihood. So you want to have a likelihood function for one observable. You want to compare it to the predictions from the particular point in parameter space you're interested in. And then you also want to multiply that by the likelihood function for another observable to get your total composite likelihood.
Although one difficulty with doing that, which is actually related to the mass plot you showed, is that there is statistical uncertainties, but there are also model uncertainties. I think, for example, from all of the direct detection, there are all uncertainties from upper physics, which you can quite sort of capture the distance.
You can, actually. So
you can, once you include them, but yes. you cannot just overplot the statistics and you actually have to redo the analysis for different
aspects. Yes. Well, I mean, you're not really overplotting anything in what I'm talking about here either. So I'm talking about making a combined constraint. So, I mean, you need to do that with all of your uncertainties as well. So things, say like, you know, the dark matter velocity distribution, you need to include the parameters of that distribution as nuisance parameters in your fit and then marginalize or profile over those as well, yeah. That's the slightly more advanced example, but yeah.
Well, I guess it becomes more relevant for lighter dark matter.
It's relevant for everything, really, because there are always systematic uncertainties in basically all of these searches. I mean, some of them are theoretical uncertainties, some of them are experimental uncertainties.
No, but for 100 GeV dark matter, what you choose for your model, for your label, it's not going to affect your results by, more than order 100.
It depends on what search you're looking at. If you're looking at...
For the direct detection.
Oh, for direct detection, yeah. Sure. Well, it also depends on the target material, right? And it also, you can look at uncertainties from form factors, for example. For some of the heavier nucleons, the form factors are so uncertain, you might worry about up to an order of magnitude difference.
Yeah, I think those things are more relevant for light dark matter. For 100 GeV dark matter, those things are all pretty worthless. But what kind of uncertainties?
For indirect detection, for example, right. I mean, you have to worry about your J factors and all of these things. For the Higgs decay, that's a little bit tricky because in that case, it's actually this actually already comes from some kind of combined likelihood, and we've just cherry-picked the result that we're most interested in. Mm-hmm. So there are actually a whole bunch of correlated systematics that go into that. So if you want to include those carefully, you have to do it in quite a bit more detail. So there's a systematic from the luminosity, like how well the luminosity of the LHC is understood in the first place. And then there are, I guess, are also systematics from the QCD loop directions. Those would probably be the dominant ones. But yeah, I'm sure there are others that in principle we should also include.
So what are the different lines on this?
Yeah, so on this plot, we've got the combined limit from Fermi dwarf searches for dark matter annihilation and limits on dark matter annihilation at redshift of 600 or so from WMAT. So everything below this is ruled out. And then these other curves are future limits, so expected limits. This is, and particularly once you include CTA, it gets a lot stronger. So this is the 90% confidence level, and then this is just the one sigma confidence level. But so, the point I was trying to make in this slide was that, this is qualitatively different. You're doing a qualitatively different thing here because this one curve is a composite likelihood from these three experiments. Whereas this black curve is basically a single likelihood function that you've just decided to draw some line at some confidence level, which in this case is 2 sigma, and said that that's it from that observation. Whereas here, you've still picked some level, but your likelihood function contains data from three different experiments. And it's essentially like doing a chi-square on one bin versus three bins. It's not an especially complicated or deep or fundamental thing, but it's basically dotting all your I's and crossing all of your T's correctly. So you then have the issue of what you do if you're actually looking at much more complicated models that have more than two parameters, so something you can't just represent in terms of a simple two-dimensional plane. Then you actually need to scan the parameter space of these models in some kind of smart way, and I'll quantify smart a bit more later on. And then you need to have some way of interpreting the results intelligently. So that means that you actually need to do your statistics properly. So first of all, you need to decide whether you're going to interpret it in terms of Bayesian or frequentist statistics, and then follow all of the machinery that way. You might want to do both and compare, which is typically what I do. And then you need to be able to project down to the subspaces of interest to you. So if you want to plot the allowed regions in some particular two-dimensional plane, you need to have some prescription for doing that. And typically the way you do that is either to marginalize over the other parameters, so that's integrating over all of the other things not in the plane you're interested in, or you profile over them, which means that you maximize the likelihood in all of the hidden directions. And so once you do all of this properly, then you're doing global fits. Go ahead.
So first, what do you mean by Bayesian versus frequentist? What priors do you mean?
So if you actually want to do something in a proper frequentist way, the priors don't make or should not make any difference, right? So
right, because you can always put your priors into your likelihood and call it frequentist analysis.
No, that's not a frequentist analysis. That's still a Bayesian analysis.
No, you can always put, if you believe the prior is really an objective assessment, then you can always put it into the likelihood.
Not unless you want to call it a nuisance likelihood. If you have an actual measurement of some nuisance parameter, then sure. But that's not a prior. That's an actual likelihood.
No, but if you have any kind of objective reason to believe that a data point should be what it is, or a parameter should be what it is, you can always put it into a likelihood. The only kind of things that makes a difference in Bayesian frequencies is just whatever is objective state stuff you decide to put in.
No, it's not the only thing. It's this process actually, this marginalization or profiling.
So that's what I'm about to say next. That there is that's another issue, and it's true that there is no proof that the profile is equal to the marginalized. But in terms of the level of just writing your likelihood,
in the limit of everything being Gaussian and very well measured, it is equal. But
right, not. But that's what I'm asking. So what you, when you say Bayesian, if you choose to be Bayesian, what kind of thing are you imagining?
I imagine in cases where you actually have to, where you have a choice of prior on your parameters, say a choice of one parameterization or another is essentially a prior. So if you say that, I guess the classic one is this fine-tuning prior on the ZMAS, this Barbieri-Guidici criterion. So if you want to set up your parameterization in terms of weak scale Suzy parameters versus gut scale Suzy parameters, you're basically, and you're saying I'm going to take a linear prior on all of my parameters, or if you're saying I'm going to take a log prior on all of my parameters, you're still imposing different priors by choosing a different parameterization. And in principle, that won't, if you do your scan correctly, that won't make any difference to the conclusions you draw from a frequentist scan, whereas it will from a Bayesian scan. Because in the Bayesian case, you're marginalizing. So you're doing the integral over all of the other, doing the integral over of the posterior PDF over all of the other dimensions. So then you have this volume effect, basically. Whereas in the frequentist case, you're just maximizing the likelihood over these other dimensions. So it doesn't matter as long as you've found the best likelihood, regardless of you know, what sort of metric you've used to search. So long as you've found it, then the profile likelihood should turn out to be the same.
Right. All I'm saying is that those are subjective decisions. They're not objective decisions.
You mean whether you choose to do it in a Bayesian or frequentist way?
Even the profile is... so all your choices of priors, so things like judicial measure, whether you use gut scale versus weak scale, all those things are subjective decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's useful to Bayesian.
Yeah, well... It depends on if you are a Bayesian or a frequentist. The Bayesians would say that's exactly why you should do a Bayesian analysis, and the frequentists would say that's actually exactly why you should do a frequentist analysis.
Right, and I think the difference is not so much the analysis as much as what you take as subjective assumptions, which are not based on any data.
No, it's about whether your results should depend on subjective assumptions or not. So the Bayesians perfectly happy for it too, whereas the frequentists would say my results should not depend on these at all.
That's what I'm saying, that if you believe something is objective, you can always put it into the likelihood. And so if the moment you want to start including subjective assumptions that are not based on data, that's when you have to start using Bayesian. But
yeah,
if
sure.
it's objective,
sure.
you can get it away. But it's not like one of them is better than the other.
No. And that was actually part of the point I was trying to make. I'm saying that, I mean, you can really choose to do it either way, and it depends on philosophically how you believe statistics is correctly done. I mean, I actually think that there are good arguments for doing it either way. And so I think it's usually good to do it both ways and then compare the conclusions that you would draw from those, because you actually learn slightly different things from doing the two different analyses. So usually you get more information out of looking at both of them and comparing them, basically. But I mean, even if you don't put in any subjective assumptions, you know, you will get a different result out of a Bayesian analysis in principle. So it does still matter in that sense. And it's basically just because of the marginalization versus the profile. Okay, so there are a number of groups that do things that sort of might smell a little bit like global fits, whereas only some of them are actually global fits and some of them are not really. And it's worthwhile understanding which ones are and which ones aren't and why, I guess. Typically, these have only been done so far for supersymmetry. So all of these examples are with Suzy. So if you're doing a global fit, the point is that per point, you always have a quantitative result, as in you know to what confidence level a particular point in a parameter space is excluded, right? But you all also have a statement about parameter spaces as a whole and subspaces as a whole, because you've actually done a statistical analysis of the space as such. So you've scanned over the parameters in such a way that you are either confident you've found the best fit point or that you've calculated the posterior PDF well enough to integrate it and be able to tell everyone what the evidence is for a particular region of the parameter space or the model as a whole. So this is an example. These are both examples in the constraint MSSM. So this is from the Superbayes group. This is from the master code collaboration. And here you see we've basically got credible regions, this is a Bayesian analysis, and confidence intervals or confidence regions for M0 and M1 half. So this is the one sigma confidence region, this is the two sigma confidence region, and then likewise the credible regions over here and the Bayesian fit. Yes, yeah, exactly.
But it looks roughly the same, right?
Yeah, it is roughly the same. It's using basically the same data. These are the most up-to-date results from both of these groups. And, I mean, the take-home message here is that as far as the CMSSM goes, everything's kind of crap, but the least crap areas are the tip of the style co-annihilation region. But in contrast, SUSY scans that are not global fits are not quantitative at the level of the overall parameter space. And that's because there's no overriding statistical analysis going on here. So they're basically just picking different points and either calculating a full likelihood for them in some cases and saying this is good to this sort of confidence level, or they're just imposing sort of thresholds and saying I'll allow this if it passes threshold in these three or four different experiments. So that's what's been done in these couple of cases. So this is from the Rizzo et al. Group, and this is from our own group, basically just taking a bunch of different points, and in this case it's a 25 parameter MSSM, in this case it's a 19 or 20 parameter MSSM, and saying for each point how strongly excluded that particular point in the parameter space is, so that particular model.
So what are the blue, for example, represent?
It's a bit hard to read, isn't it? So the blue ones here are models that can be excluded at better than 5 sigma by IceCube 86 plus deep core. And then the light blue is 3 sigma, and then the green is 1 sigma, and the red is not excludable. So you can do this to say on a point-by-point basis what's good and what's bad. But you can't extrapolate over to the whole parameter space in that case, because all you've done is pick individual points. You haven't done the scan in any kind of way that lets you make a general statement about what's the best fit point or what's the probability integrated over a certain region of parameter space. Now, this group, they usually take the number of points that they've seen in particular regions of subspaces and say, you know, what fraction of those points are excluded, but that doesn't actually mean anything. It's kind of like a poor man's Bayesian analysis, but it's not actually a Bayesian analysis because they haven't scanned the parameter space in such a way that the number of points in any particular region has any correlation necessarily to the probability of models in that region being correct. So what you have here is basically sort of two related goals, really. So if I have a particular theory, I want to know which parameter combinations fit all of the experiments and how well. But I also want to be able to compare this for different theories. So this is parameter estimation, whereas this is model comparison. And in general, if you do a good parameter estimation, you can then, in multiple models, you can then use it to do a model comparison. And this is essentially what I was saying before. So if you only look at individual points and you don't have any sort of sampling method that actually produces points with a density that's proportional to the probability of the points being correct, then you don't have any sort of overall goodness of fit measure, and you don't have any measure of the convergence of your scan or anything like that. So you can't actually take the frequency of models anywhere in particular to mean anything about that region of parameter space being good or bad. All you can say is that the individual models are good or bad and at what level. So, you know, this is why you want to actually go and do a proper statistical global fit, if possible. And, I mean, the reason that you may not is that this is quite hard. It's technically much more difficult than doing this sort of stuff. Just sampling randomly or semi-randomly in your parameter space is relatively easy because you don't have to worry about convergence. You don't have to worry about how well you've gotten around the parameter space.
Well, although, to be fair towards what they've done, what you guys have done, you know, in the back of your mind, when you do something like that, you have this sort of assumption of sort of smoothness of the other spaces that you don't. But when once you marginalize all them over them, you won't find that you're completely dominated by a very sharp part of the parameters.
That's one assumption, but that's not enough to making quantitative statements about the density of points valid.
Once the dimension of the other spaces you marginalize over becomes huge, power out breaks loose. But generally, things are smooth. You won't expect huge deviations from this picture.
No, but suppose
you're going to do something better. I'm not arguing against what you're
doing. It's true that you won't have extreme deviations from this naive picture, in that you may not find other fine-tuned areas of parameter space that have fantastically better fits, right? But if you're sampling in a random way, you're still not necessarily sampling in a way that the density of points is proportional to the probability. So if in some direction in parameter space the probability is higher at large values of the parameter than at small values, you're still sampling flatly across that parameter, and any inference you make on the basis of that uniform sampling is not really correct. Okay, so if you want to do a global fit, there are a few different issues you have to worry about. So the first one is, how do you combine likelihoods for different experiments? And I've already alluded to this. You make up a composite likelihood. So you basically make up likelihood functions for different experiments, like all of these things, dark matter relic density, precision electroweak tests, various limits from LEP and B factories and things like that, LHC searches, direct detection, and so on. And you basically just multiply the different likelihood functions. If your likelihood functions are simple enough that they're actually just chi-squares, that's just a matter of adding chi-squares. And this is what I was saying about it just being like adding up chi-squared for different bins. So that's easy enough. Second issue is about including uncertainties on your input data. So this is this also covers theoretical uncertainty. So this is what Ite was talking about. The way to do this is to treat them as nuisance parameters. So this means that you have your theoretical uncertainty or your systematic uncertainty as an additional parameter in your fit, and you scan over that as well. And then you either integrate that out or you maximize your likelihood across it, like any other parameter. So that's also relatively straightforward. The trickier things are actually finding the points that have the best likelihood. So this is how you do the scan numerically in the parameter space, so how you move around the parameter space and make sure you found the best fit points, and how you've sampled the parameter space well enough to actually be able to do this integration over or maximization over the parameters that you're not interested in. And then finally, you have to worry about how you're going to do the comparison of different models. And there are a few different choices for doing this, depending on whether you want to do Bayesian statistics or frequentist statistics, and then even within those. And your choices here for issue three will dictate what you can actually do on this fourth point. And one of the things I listed here is comparing p-values for the best fits. So this is basically comparing how good your best fits are in different theories. But in order to really do that reliably, you have to worry about the distribution of your likelihood function or your test statistic. And this also has implications for things like statistical issues like coverage, which if there's time, I'll talk more about later on. Okay, so individual searches. So the first thing I was going to talk about was putting gamma ray data into global fits. So if you want to include indirect searches for dark matter in global fits, you have a couple of different choices for how you might do it. So the simplest way of doing it is to just take the published limits on the annihilation cross-section. And I mean, this goes equally well for direct detection as well, or directly on the nuclear scattering cross-sections, and just use those essentially as they are. This is quick because you don't need to recalculate anything, you just use the limit as it is, but it's not very accurate because typically the limits you get from the experiments published papers on, say, the annihilation cross-section assume annihilation 100% into some particular final state, say like BB bar or tau plus tau minus or something like that. Whereas in the models you want to look at a specific point in your model parameter space, you have some mixed annihilation, typically, right? So you might go 20% into tau plus tau minus and 80 into BB bar. And it's not necessarily obvious how to combine the different limits from these different assumed annihilation final states. So you almost never have the full likelihood function available in that case. So what you often want to do really is reconstruct the experimental likelihood function so that you can then plug in any model that you happen to care about with whatever mixture of branching fractions you want. So this is nice because it's accurate, but it's slow because you basically need to do some kind of fast detector simulation as you go. And so, you know, you can imagine what the direct analogy is with LHC searches, for example. You either take the published limits on the CMS SEM and apply them directly, or you actually do a detector simulation and get your new limits. Or you try to adapt something else, like a simplified model spectrum. So the approach that I've been taking is actually to set up explicit likelihood functions for different dark matter searches and put them in global fits. The other thing you can do for indirect detection in some cases is just use flux upper limits, which is sort of a nice little short circuit, which lets you do most of this stuff without having to do all of it.
But is it possible to also just create templates once and for all, rather than recompute it for every model? I mean, the kind of general thing you can have is annihilation of the bar and neutrino, just create templates for those things.
It depends.
Because the energy spectrum may be very different?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're actually looking at the energy spectrum, if you have a likelihood that's based on counts at individual energies, then you can't do that. But if you're interested in the integrated the limit on the integrated flux in some energy region, you can do that. Yeah. All right, so this first example, what we did was to take Fermi searches for dark matter annihilation towards the Segbo-1 dwarf galaxy and use it to mix into the constrained MSSM global fits. So we had basically a full instrumental treatment with the point spread function, energy dispersion, all of that, and then calculated a Poissonian likelihood function using the actual counts in different energy bins, different directions in the sky for searches towards Segbo. So it was nice. It was basically a proof of concept. As you probably know, the 9-month Fermi data wasn't really especially constraining, so it didn't affect the parameter space that much. But it means we have a likelihood function that we can use now for any Fermi data, basically. We did a similar thing with the Hess gamma ray telescope, and here we combined a whole bunch of different searches. So this was searches in the Carina and Sculptor dwarf galaxies and also the Sagittarius dwarf. And what Hess called the Milky Way, but this is basically the halo. The Milky Way halo just beyond the galactic center, so it's kind of galactic center minus the very center. And it turns out that particularly because of the Sagittarius dwarf, Hess actually disfavors a whole bunch of models down here in the star constellation region because they have strong virtual internal Bremsstrahl, actually. And so these get caught at high energy by Hess. Now, this result has weakened substantially since we put it out because it turned out the J factor that was previously estimated for the Sagittarius dwarf was a bit too large. Well, a lot too large. But it at least, it highlights that you can actually really start to think about getting at models with quite low annihilation cross-sections with their Cherenkov telescopes, basically through this virtual internal Bremsstrahl.
So what will the J factor? Why will it overestimate?
It's because it was originally based on the assumption that Sagittarius is not at all perturbed, that it wasn't disturbed, whereas it's in the middle of a stream or something like that. So the J factor is actually a lot lower than people initially thought. I think it was like an order of magnitude lower. So then we went on to do the same thing, or similar thing with neutrinos coming from the sun. So this is basically like a cartoon outline of how you might expect to find neutrinos from dark matter annihilation in the sun with neutrino telescopes. So, I mean, everybody's probably very familiar with this, so I'll zip through it quickly. So you expect weak scattering on nucleons in the sun, then the WIMPs become gravitationally bound, sink down to the center of the sun and annihilate with each other there, and you look for some of the standard model particles coming out. So all of the standard model particles that come out end up heating the core, except for the neutrinos, which propagate and oscillate their way out of the sun and hopefully eventually get detected here on Earth with something like IceCube or Antares. So what we were looking for were high-energy neutrinos in IceCube from this signal, and then trying to use the individual neutrino events in a similar way to how we did with gamma rays to put direct constraints on models in these global fits. So the simplest way to do anything like this is to just make it a counting problem, right? So the first thing we did was set up a number likelihood. So you compare the number of neutrino events you see towards the sun to the number you predict for a particular model. So that's this number likelihood here. So this is the likelihood of seeing a number of events n given a predicted number of background events and a predicted number of signal events. And in this case, we just this is actually just a Poisson likelihood, but it's been marginalized analytically over a nuisance parameter here, epsilon. And this epsilon describes the departure from one, basically, for the effective area of IceCube. So this describes the systematic uncertainty on the effective area. So this width of the distribution here that we took to be log normal was about 20% or so for IceCube. So this is essentially like a quick way of avoiding having to marginalize numerically over your nuisance parameters. And then upgraded this to include full spectral and angular information for each of the events. So these particular functions are quite messy, so I won't actually bother showing them in detail. But the point is that for each event, you have direction and energy information, and you also have the total number of events, so you can really construct a full likelihood function.
But maybe I misunderstand what you're saying. So there is the energy distribution of like how the muons would look like, the muon distribution, but the neutrinos themselves are generally just monochromatic. If it's coming from... Oh, because they're thinking... Oh, no,
they're processed.
Something that's fairly annihilation directly, right? They're thinking about general annihilation.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so if you annihilate directly into neutrinos, that'll be monochromatic, that's true. But if you go to, you know, TT bar, you'll get a spectrum of neutrinos from processing inside the sun. Yeah. So this information was not publicly available from IceCube. So this is actually stuff that we did in collaboration with IceCube. And it's now is publicly available. So part of the point was to make the IceCube data... Or to work out a format for making it available to the community that was going to be useful. So all of this likelihood implementation and also the data is available in DarkSUSY 506 and later. And so we've done this for 22 string IceCube stuff so far, and we're in the process of finishing off the same thing for the 79 string and then later 86 string IceCube data. So this is just an example of how well you could do. This is just taking a mock signal, so basically injecting 60 events into the real data for a WIMP that annihilates 100% into W plus W minus, and then seeing how well we'd be able to reconstruct it if we had the same SSM, for example. So this is the WIMP mass versus the predicted number of events. This is the true point here with the cross. And the colored contours are using all of the information, and the gray contours are using only the angular and number information, so not including the energy stuff. So one thing you can see is that we can reconstruct it fairly well, considering just realization noise. It's on about the one sigma contour. And you can also see that including the energy information improves things a reasonable amount, which is nice because the energy information had not previously been included in IceCube searches for dark matter. And then over here you have the corresponding regions in the WIMP mass versus spin-dependent nuclear scattering plane. So here you can see by including the energy information, you get rid of this spurious solution at high nuclear scattering cross-section at low mass. So then just as an example here, I've got the CMSM parameter space and the impacts that you would expect on it from putting in a bunch of different complementary observables. So this is not especially up to date, but it's basically just an illustration of the sorts of things you can do with global fits once you start including everything. So this is where you would start off basically pre-LHC. So you've got M0, M1/2, and then the spin-dependent nuclear scattering cross-sections. Put in Xenon-100, you chop out the larger spin-independent scattering cross-sections. Put in the CMS 5 inverse femtobun results, you basically only get at a bit of the Stoukhov annihilation region. And then if you look at what IceCube86 will do, what we expect it will do, it'll actually chop out a whole lot more of basically of the focus point, which is this region. So, you know, we don't know exactly what IceCube86's limits will look like, but we think probably it'll be pretty similar to 100 times what IceCube22 will do. So that's how we've modeled it. So it looks like IceCube86 will actually be fairly constraining for supersymmetry.
On the left block where M1/2 or M0, what does each point represent?
Each point. Sorry, these things?
No, so like the red, what does the red part represent?
Sorry, yeah, I zipped through that a bit quickly. So the color coding gives you the relative probability. So
yeah.
This is the 1 sigma credible region, the red stuff. The blue stuff is the 2 sigma credible region. And then the grey stuff is how those contours looked just for the base observables case.
Right. So before you, if you move back one observable, right.
Yeah.
So at that point, without IceCube, you would conclude that's the parameter space would have based on some measure that we decided on.
Yeah. If you took a linear prior. Yeah.
And
bear in mind that this is the 2011 Xenon result. So this is just an example. In reality, the 2012 Xenon result would also disfavor that quite substantially.
Right, and the other plots are just, you know, using different parameterization of the same kind of models.
It's exactly the same model. It's not even a different parameterization. These are just observables of that model.
Right.
So for each point in this parameter space, you just calculate what the scattering cross section is.
I mean, good parameterization because here you're talking about M kind one.
Yeah, okay, you can think of it as a reparameterization.
But no, I got it. Good. Yeah. And you're showing how your inference changes as you're getting more data.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we did a similar thing with this MSM25 model. This is not one of those global fits, and basically because it's a 25 parameter MSSM model, it's very hard to get a convergent global fit on such a model. And you'll see at the end of the talk, this is what we're working on at the moment. But if you want to work with this model at the moment, you basically need to do these sort of random scans. And this, again, basically shows you which models in the MSM25 we think IceCube86 will be able to get at strongly. So the ones that are in dark blue are the ones that are going to be excluded at 5 sigma. And these limits give you the current direct detection limits. So you can see there are a number of models that IceCube will be able to get at that direct detection won't. So it's good news for IceCube. I think I can probably... Well, this shows the same scan, but then in terms of the planes that you often see for LHC searches, and then compared to simplified model spectrum limits from LHC searches. And the take-home point here is that there are a whole bunch of dark blue points way beyond the naive simplified model limits. So you expect that IceCube will also be able to get at a bunch of models that the LHC can't, which is also not so surprising. But if you want to do this properly, of course, you know, you can't just apply this bound because that does not apply to each of these models, right? Because this is just assuming a simplified model spectrum, whereas these are MSM25 models. And then finally, we set up some very simple likelihoods for including CMB constraints. So in this case, we basically did essentially what Ito was talking about, taking templates for annihilation into the different possible standard model final states, working out what their impact would be on the CMB, Or rather, we used previous calculations of what the impact would be on the CMB and then set them up in a very easy to use form that lets you combine them to make an overall likelihood function for whatever combination of branching fractions you're interested in, both for annihilation and for decay. So for annihilation, it basically just looks like this. You have to interpolate this F effective parameter for whatever mass and branching fractions you're interested in, and hey presto, you've got a likelihood function. Correspondingly for decay, you have to do the same thing for this eta parameter. It doesn't mean exactly the same thing as F effective, but it's basically the single parameter that you need to work out as a function of your lifetime, dark matter mass, and the different decay branching fractions. So then you've got a likelihood basically for any dark matter model that annihilates or decays. So these are just some examples of what you can do with that. You can basically draw the corresponding limits on the annihilation cross-section for different final states. This is what I've shown here. As is pretty well understood, the strongest limits come from annihilation into electrons and gamma rays. So this basically just fits with the previous work. And then you can do the same thing for decays. So this is if you cast it in terms of the fraction of dark matter that exists in decaying dark matter for decaying to E plus E minus. And we put this out for both WMAP and projected Planck constraints. And I should point out that at the moment, WMAP is actually still the most constraining for CMB because Planck hasn't put out polarization results yet. Okay, so that's basically that as far as including searches for dark matter and global fits. How am I going for time?
10.
Yeah, okay. So I'll briefly say something about the future challenges we have. So respectable LHC likelihoods, the problem here is that if you naively want to set up a respectable LHC likelihood, it will take a very long time to calculate for every single point in your parameter space because you have to do a proper detector simulation, you have to generate 50,000 events and so on. So per point in your model parameter space, you'll take a minute or so at best. Whereas if you want your global fits to actually converge in a statistical sense, you kind of have to aim for a second at worst. So you're about two orders of magnitude off here, just in terms of your actual implementation. You've got to get a 100-fold speed up. So the sort of zeroth order response to this so far has been, that's too hard. Okay, well, we'll just use the published limits on M0 and M1/2, and we'll just implement them directly. And you know that's the best we can do at the moment. I mean, this is obviously problematic because the limits assume the same as M for a start, but they assume certain values for tan beta and a naught as well. Whereas if you're doing a CMSM scan, you're also scanning over tan beta and a naught, so you're changing them. So they're not really applicable. And you also don't have a likelihood function. You just have an exclusion curve. So it's not very helpful either. So this is what has been done so far with the supervised code. The first order response is to go a little bit further than that and actually test how that limit moves as you change A naught and tan beta and kind of hope that the result of that test is that it doesn't very much, and luckily enough, it doesn't that much. So that's good. You still don't really have a likelihood function then. You basically just have an exclusion curve and that's it. But you have some sort of likelihood in that you've been able to simulate things so you can see at least in this two-dimensional plane how the likelihood changes, and you can kind of estimate that maybe it doesn't change too much if you change A naught and tan beta. So you can extrapolate that basically, but it's a little bit shaky. It's a lot shaky, particularly if you want to go to models that are a long way away from the CMSSM. And this is what's been done so far in Fitino and MasterCode. So what we really want to do is to speed up this calculation somehow, right? To do the full calculation, but to do it quickly enough. And so this is, what we're trying to do at the moment. So this is the real challenge. So There are a few different ways you could potentially do this. You could try to set up your likelihood function so that you don't have to calculate the event rates at every single model point. So you can basically, hopefully, interpolate your likelihood somehow or interpolate your cross-section somehow, either by some more standard interpolation techniques or maybe via some kind of neural network functional approximation to the likelihood or to the cross-section. Or maybe you can come up with some kind of even smarter reduction that's based on the event topology, sort of along the lines of the simplified model spectrum sort of thinking. Or maybe there's something else you can do. The neural network and interpolated likelihood route is something that's been followed a bit by these authors, but there's still quite a ways to go in that respect. So then the second thing I wanted to mention was statistical and numerical.
I think one of the ones that we're discussing for giving the likelihood.
Sort of. There was a very serious effort of doing that with Higgs searches, with combined Higgs searches.
Also more, I mean, behind the scenes, there's also some more serious effort of doing it for general. So Kyle Kramer from NYU is doing
it. Yeah, he was doing this mostly for Higgs searches.
Mostly for Higgs searches because that's
his game.
Most likely what will happen, but people are talking about it for other things.
Yeah, and I hope it comes through. I mean, actually, we plan to actually push for this a lot more, so hopefully things will come through in that respect. But there's only so much they can do because they're not doing these sorts of scans, so they haven't calculated the likelihood function in a lot of the places that we would like it. So they can't give you what they don't have. But certainly we would like what they do have, right?
Right. Well, I mean, if you find a way to help them with all this, the real problem is manpower.
Yeah.
So if you find a way to help them with some of those efforts, it's more likely to happen.
That's essentially what we're going to try and do, certainly starting with the Higgs side of things, but also in the SUSY side. So on the numerical side, one of the problems I mentioned is that you don't always know if you've found the best fit point. So in this example, we did a scan of the CMSSM using genetic algorithms and compared it to the points you would find if you used the standard techniques, like nested sampling. So here, this is the 1 and 2 sigma regions you find using the standard techniques. The 1 sigma here is in blue, and this is what you find with the genetic algorithm. So the take-home point here is that we found a whole bunch of better fits than were being found in these supposedly converged results. So you need to be very careful about how you do the numerics. And we're not even really confident that this one's converged either. So there's probably even better ones to be found than what we found. And this is just in the constrained MSSM. So as soon as you go to the MSSM 25 or something like that, these problems become even worse. And particularly if you're doing profile likelihood, where you work out your confidence regions on the basis of basically a delta chi squared from the best fit point. So if your best fit point is off, all of your contours are off. And then this leads into problems with coverage. So coverage is basically how often do my 68% or 95% confidence level regions actually contain the true point? It should be 95 or 68% of the time, right? But very often it's not. And in order to make sure that it does, you actually really need to know the distribution of your test statistic very well, which is basically your likelihood function. And usually, if you're a hardcore experimentalist, you do this by Monte Carloing it, so you know the exact distribution of your test statistic. Whereas, when we do these global fits, we can't do that. It's far too expensive numerically. So we don't really know the distribution of the test statistic. So you have to be quite careful about what you say about, say, the p-value in terms of assessing the goodness of fit. Because if you want to calculate a p-value, you need to be pretty confident of the distribution of your test statistic. So when you see people say that such and such a SUSY model is ruled out at some level on the basis of a p-value assessment and goodness of fit, you should be a little bit skeptical.
And this problem is exacerbated the more you're profiling.
Yeah, exactly. The higher dimensional model you're looking at. Absolutely.
So do people actually have an analytic understanding of, you know, how does it become worse as the number of dimensions increase?
Oh, well, I would say no, not exactly. Probably for toy models. I'm sure statisticians would be able to give you some kind of quantifiable answer to this in terms of a parameter that gives you a departure from a Gaussian likelihood. If everything's Gaussian, then it's all fine, right? But yeah. But in complicated real life cases like this, I'd say not really. We've done three studies into this. I've been involved in two, and some other collaborators of mine have been involved in another one. Between these three studies, it looks like the coverage is more likely to be correct if the mapping from the parameters to the observables is linear. So the more non-linear that mapping becomes, the less confident you can be that your assumptions about a chi-squared distribution of the test statistic are good and that your coverage is okay. That's about as, I think, as far as the knowledge extends. Okay, and then finally, basically, you know, I said we want to move on to doing this for a whole bunch of different theories, not just for SUSY. And so I'm saying here, you know, simplified model spectra and the CMSM are not all there is to beyond the set of models. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here. So the question is, how do you adapt these global fits to actually work with other models without having to just rewrite everything from scratch? So you want to be able to quickly recast your data, your likelihood functions, all of the internal housekeeping of the code, and even the predictions into some kind of new, very abstract global fitting framework. And that's really the focus of my current work. So the problem is at the moment, you know, we're very strongly wedded to quite a small number of theories, quite a small number of observable calculators, specific data sets, and a lot of the treatment of the astroparticle observables and the LHC observables is very rough. So we're really basically hitting the wall on every aspect of global fits technically at the moment. So the idea is to make what we call a second generation global fitting tool. And this is something we're calling GAMBIT, the Global and Modular BSM Inference Tool. And the overriding principle here is basically flexibility and modularity. So you want to set it up so that you can plug in new models, new observables, new scanning techniques, all in a fairly modular and plug-and-play sort of way. And so that you can easily recast things into global fits of different theories. And this is going to be publicly available and include a very extensive observable and data library and so on. So other people can add their own theories, for example, and do their own global fits using this framework. And a very big part of it is that we're trying to set up a smart and very fast LHC likelihood calculator that's massively parallelized. So this is the collaboration. There are 22 of us at the moment. This spans 8 different experiments. So we have people from Fermi, IceCube, Atlas, LHCb. We had people from CMS, but they left and joined Atlas. And we also have a bunch of theorists. So we're about 50-50 theorists and experimentalists. And yeah, certainly as far as pushing for more likelihood results from the LHC experiments, the plan at the moment is to push mostly from within Atlas, because those are the people we have. But eventually, we'll probably also take on some CMS members and push from that direction as well. So, you know, overall, I basically, you know, I wanted to say that if you want to have robust analysis of beyond the standard model theories, you really need to do global fits. You need to combine things, and you need to combine them in the right way. And, you know, there are lots of interesting astroparticle observables to put into them, but there are also a lot of technical challenges that you really need to overcome to be able to do this as well as we would like to. And GAMBIT is on its way. Thanks.